Welcome back to So There I Was. I'm your host again, Travis Womack. Today's special guest is none other than Devin Fish. He's the author of a book called Answering the Hard Questions. Let it be the end of the chapter, not the end of the book, which is a fantastic title, by the way. We'll definitely get into that. And you've got quite a career that started a few years ago and about a decade now, and it's coming to an end. But Devin, welcome to the show.
All right, thank you for having me.
So you're up there in the wonderful world of two time zones on a military base. How's that going for you?
Oh, that's good. I live right outside the base, so I'm in Tennessee when I live there, and when I go to work, I'm in Kentucky.
So
So.
I've never been to Campbell, but I've heard that is like the biggest thing to adjust to is like your central time when you're at home and your Eastern time when you're at work or vice versa, whichever way it goes. And I'm like, oh man, that sounds like accountability nightmare.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I think it stays the same time zone when you go from Tennessee to Kentucky. However, if you go to the other part of Kentucky, which is like Fort Knox, then it's like an hour off. Or if you go to the state right above it, it's an hour off. So I'm like, it is a little weird, yeah.
That's no fun. Well, man, what I'd like to do for pretty much any guests I have is, if they were a veteran, at least for sure, is to kind of like get the story of where it started. You joined in 2016, which is, that means that you're kind of a unique generation in that most of your life, you were what, third grade? 9/11, fourth, somewhere in there?
So when I joined the military,
No, when 9/11 happened, how old were you? I'm making you do math in
probably only
public,
four or
sorry.
five because I don't think I remember
You don't
it.
remember? Okay. So but kindergarten age, and it's all your entire growing up, we're at war and you decided to join. I think you're the first guest I've had that kind of falls in that category. So walk us through kind of that, your perception of going through junior high and high school, honestly, with the peak of the war and then making that decision.
I actually stumbled into the army kind of by accident. When I go into the background of my life, I didn't really come from a very good life. I came from like poverty. I was pretty unstable when I grew up, so I moved within my 18 years before I joined the military. I moved 16 times.
Wow.
And I live with in everything from like a house all the way down to like a motel. Living conditions weren't always great, so sometimes we didn't have like AC. There's times where we didn't have hot water, and there's a couple weeks where we didn't even have like a toilet to use.
Wow.
So that gives you a little background. I grew up
Who's
with my mother, but I
also say,
also
who's we, you and your mom? Sorry, I cut you off there.
so originally it was with my mother until I got around to middle school. Then my life got really unstable. And then it went back and forth. So I've lived with my mother, my dad, my grandmother, grandparents. I've lived with two different aunts, and then I've also lived with friends of family as well. So roughly about every year or two, I was moving at that time.
Golly.
And even when I joined the military, like if you look at my deployments and like rotations and stuff like that, that was like another 16 moves. Like I added it up for the book, and it's like 31 times I've moved, and I'm like 28 years old right now. So I'm always going all over the place. I'm used to it by now.
I think you're set for
So that
life.
part's not so bad. Yeah, because I looked up the average time, and it's like 12 moves throughout in someone's entire lifetime. I've already, tripled that. So, I
Golly.
guess I'm going for a record at this point. But what ended up happening is I think it was my sophomore year, I ended up failing out of one of my classes. I wasn't doing very good. I was always smart, but I developed a early mindset of not caring, which turned into, depression, self-hatred later down the road. Failed out of one of my classes, and my dad was on to me for about a year. He's like, during the summer, he's like, "Hey, you're going to go get a job. It's not an option." So I started doing these resumes, but every time I got a resume, I would show him the picture and the resume. I ended up throwing all the resumes out when he wasn't like looking and stuff like that. So I was pretty rebellious at the time. And he's like, "Well," and after a couple months, he kind of figured it out. So he's like, "Have you ever thought about joining the military?" I'm like, "Sure," just to get him off my back. So he's like, "Cool," called my bluff. We went down to the recruiter's office that same day, and we happened to go into the Army recruiter's office. I ended up liking what they said. And it was also a way to get my dad off my back. But when I did that, I did delayed entry for about a year. I joined in my junior year. Still had some rough grades going on around that time. There's one phone call my dad got like before, a couple months before I shipped out. I was missing like 50 assignments in just one class alone. So that wasn't a very good conversation. It did help me though, because part of the delayed entry program is like you go work out with them once a week. So it almost kind of like it was like that pre-family setting to where the army was getting used to you being around them and stuff like that. So that actually helped with all the instability that was kind of going on in my life. And really, the start of my army career and the talking about that instability is where chapter one of the book starts. And it starts pretty much me shipping to basic training. So in 2016, that's when I shipped off for basic training to Fort Leonard Wood. It was about a month or two before that. I was getting ready to graduate high school. And then a month later, I was getting ready to join the military. Got off the bus that day. It was the summer. And as soon as I did, our apartment complex, which housed about 20 or 30 people, was surrounded by police vehicles. I was living with my father at the time. And, based on my life already, I was like, I'm probably not going to have a very good day, am I? Kind of one of those hunches. And so I walk up to the police. They confirmed it. They're like, hey, we're not going to allow you to go in this apartment. We don't want you to see what's going on right now. So they had to escort me off the premises. So they took me to my aunt's, which was about 2 miles down the road. And then they gave her all the information. So the first thing we found out was that my dad resisted arrest. So essentially what happened is that they had to tase him and they had to sedate him and then they had to take him to the hospital. So that's where we went. So we went to the hospital, got there, discovered, his arms were like covered in blood and cuts and stuff like that. And then he was like handcuffed to the bedpost stuff. And from there, he saw us, he was trying to kind of like turn away because he was pretty ashamed at that point. And he was also pretty angsty. And the reason he was very angsty, one, he didn't want to see, his family in that condition. The other one was what they told us actually went down in that apartment was that he had both Fireball whiskey and cocaine in his system. And so essentially what happened, it was an explosive combination and, it was pure adrenaline at that point. And so we didn't know how bad it was until I had to go back to the apartment because I was still in school. I had to go back to school. I think this was on a Friday, so I still had to go back to school on Monday. So I had to go get my clothes and stuff like that. And then we got to the apartment. I think there was tape on it, saying warning, don't go in for a crime scene and stuff like that. We opened that apartment, and the first thing my aunt says, like, if they didn't know my dad was alive, they would have thought he was dead from all the blood in that apartment. So, like, there's blood on the floor, like the walls, the ceilings, and everything in that apartment was broken. And, the first thing I imagine he broke was like this glass table that we had at the center, which would make sense with like all the blood. But it wasn't just that, it was like we had tables, like the cabinets, the refrigerator was busted open, TV, laptop, stuff like that. And there was like even an AC vent, that was, hooked into the wall, and he threw it through the window. So that'll tell you like how much adrenaline was going through the
Yeah,
system
same. That's
and why, he resists arrest.
everything's maximum strength effort on that.
Yeah. So that was like an extraordinarily graphic scene. And then from there, he's recovering, and then I'm on my way out. I'm graduating high school, and then I leave to go join basic training. And life doesn't get any easier. In fact, it gets a lot worse before it gets a lot better. So I'm 18 at the time when all this is going down. I go to Fort Leonard Wood. Couple weeks in, I discover I'm not really good at rifle marksmanship. I failed by one shot. So they're like, hey, we gotta recycle you. So get recycled, pass it, never failed rifle marksmanship after that, learn my lesson. So at that point, I'm there for like 3, 4 months in basic training. And then I go to my AIT. I originally signed to be a 68 Charlie, which is a nurse for people who don't know.
Thank
Very
you for
hard
clarifying
school, has a,
that.
yep, has about a 70% dropout rate. I didn't know that until I got to the course, because essentially what they do is they cram 3 years of school into one. And so 5 weeks into the course, I fail out. And at that point, the Army doesn't really let you go. They're like, hey, you still owe 6 years. So we're going to place your needs at the Army. And they kind of gave me two options at that point. They're like, hey, you can be a cook or you can be a scout. So I was like, all right, I'll be a scout. Because that sounded like the better of two evils at the time. And then for people who don't know, so 19 Delta or Scout, your basic training and your OSET, your AIT for them is linked together. So then I had to go back to basic training for the third time within a year. And so I was stuck in basic training environment for like a year straight.
Oh no.
So I started at Leonard Wood. Then I went to Fort Sam Houston, which is the 68 Charlie, and then I went to Benning. So that was my third basic training cycle. So that was the
Man.
start to my military career. So I was going backwards, long before, I even got a fresh start. And then I get done with that basic training cycle. Everything, in life is starting to go a little bit more organized. And then my mother parts of the story happens. So at this time, I'm 19 years old. I get to Fort Hood, Texas. I'm in reception. I think it was like my first or second day at reception. Got a phone call from my mother. It was no big deal. She's like, hey, it was 2 weeks from my birthday. So she wanted to wish me like a happy birthday just in case I got a little busy. And then she also wanted to see how I was, fitting in and stuff like that. We say, love you. And then I didn't know it at the time, but that was going to be the last time I talked to my mother at the age of 19. So next morning, I get a phone call from my aunt, and then I get a phone call from the Red Cross. They're like, hey, you need to come back to the States. Your mom's not doing so well. And to give some background on my mother, before we get to that part, so she was also going through her own issues. She also struggled with like drugs and alcohol throughout her life. Her thing was more of pain medication, because she had like a back injury because she used to be a factory worker. But she got addicted to them, and to the point where I used, as a teenager, I put two and two together. I was like, I can see her buying, selling, and doing all this other stuff with the pain medication. And this was going on at the same time with all my issues my father was going through and all the moves and stuff like that. And so to give people like an idea of, if you've never seen like someone hooked on pain medication, it pretty much like zombifies the person, is what I say in the book, is like, the person themselves is their body's there, but their mind is like completely gone. And like one day I was having a conversation with her, probably 16 or 17. She's standing up and her head just starts bobbing, and she like pretty much dazes out like while standing up. And I started avoiding my mother a long time after that.
Where was she
But the
at?
odd
Like,
part
sorry,
was,
when you were at Hood, where was she, what state was she in? Where was she at?
so she was in Rockford, Illinois. So I think I forgot to skip that part because we went straight into the Army. Rockford, not a good city. So they're rated 5 out of 100 on the crime scale, or which for people that means that
Oh, bad.
95% of the United States is safer than
Safer, you're
Rockford,
right.
Illinois. So drugs and alcohol was a common thing around there.
They give you that scale and it's like, oh, it's a five, it's great. You're like, no, it's reverse, it's backwards.
Yep, 5 out of 100, not good.
Lot was the same way. I think a lot was like a three. I'm like, ooh. Sorry, go ahead.
I think we barely get edged out by like Detroit and some of the others, and that's about it. Or like St. Louis, which is the same state. But yeah, so she was going through all our issues, but it was unexpected because when I was going through basic training, she had actually got her life back on track. She got off the drugs and all that other stuff. Right, she had a job, a car. She got out of the old place she was in. And so the Red Cross message was very unexpected. Now, because she had the back injury, so she was still on pain medication, but it didn't seem like she was
Controlled.
abusing it. So I got to the hospital, and they're pretty much like, hey, she had a bad reaction to the medication. It pretty much fried her brain from the inside out. I'm the eldest son. So within the first couple minutes, they're like, hey, you're going to have to be the one that makes a decision to keep her on life support or let her go. And then, eventually I decided to let her go for her religious practice and stuff like that. And then the nurse walks in as I'm making that decision. They're like, hey, there's nothing we can do. We're gonna have to let her go no matter what you decided at this point. So at the age of 19, I headed to my first unit at Fort Hood, Texas. I had to watch my mother die, and this is also 2 weeks from my
Golly.
birthday. So this is all, just right together. Like none of this is separated. So it's like the story from my father, the instability, the growing up, to go into through three basic training cycles, and then finally with my mother. So I'm not really having a good time at all. At this point, I'm already hating life. I'm already hating the army, the city I'm from. So I start developing a lot of self-hatred. Fast forward to around when I was 21, which was in 2019. That's where the story really starts to pick up for my side of things. Because I discovered that like once you have like a lot of self-hatred for yourself, you start to like look for it in other people. And so that's really why I ended up writing the book is because of this 1 year. And so essentially what happened, I started hopping on dating websites. So I'm like, okay, if I can't find it myself, I'll just look for it in other people. Dating websites for those people who don't have it, had that experience, they're very predatory to start with. How the system is actually developed when it purely based off your looks and you're looking at a paragraph, it's very easily for catfishing, scamming, blackmail, and everything like that. And then so I kind of got hooked on the desperations. So I was one of those people that never could find any matches, and the only matches I could find were people who wanted my money. And so at that point, I didn't really care. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to give them my money and let them do to me whatever they want to do. And so throughout that year, I got blackmailed like 7 different times. Had my bank account like zeroed out a couple times during that year because anytime I would find one person, like, and I would figure it out, I'm like, okay, I give up on this person. I'm just going to go to the next, let them blackmail me, give them anything they wanted. And then towards the end of the year, I got into the worst possible situation I could find myself in, which was the age scam. So you start a conversation, the conversation from the dating website to the texting, they swap their ages, they send a picture. And at this point, I'm like, I don't really care anymore. I'm just going to give them what they want. I'm going to allow them to blackmail me. Even though I had that kind of like sickening feeling, like probably shouldn't do this. Next day, they're like, hey, this person's in the hospital. You can either send us money or we're going to send everything over to the military. And at that point, so I'm thinking, okay, I'm probably going to get kicked out. I'm probably going to go to jail. I'm possibly going to be labeled a child predator, depending on how things go at this point. And so I played it out day by day, but the lingering thought in my head was like, how am I going to end my life for the next month or two? And that's where, the book kind of takes its turn and why I originally wrote the book. And so I would, what I was originally doing, I was sneaking off to go see a military family life counselor because they couldn't write anything down. And the only thing they could do to respond was like, if I wanted to hurt myself or someone else. And so I would sneak off when I was a scout. I think I was a newly promoted sergeant at the time. So, there's also these other issues going on
Yeah,
that a
lead
lot of people
soldiers.
couldn't see. So I'm expected to lead people when all this other stuff they don't know that's going on at this time. And so I was pretty silent about everything. And even when I was talking to the counselor, I didn't tell him anything about my background. I didn't tell him about the blackmail or anything. I'm just like, hey, I hate the army. And so eventually, after like a couple of the meetings, I'm like, hey, I've been considering ending my life at this point. And I knew they were going to send me at the hospital. And I was like, maybe this is my opportunity to get kicked out of the military at first. And that's kind of what I wanted to happen, but I'm glad they didn't. I'm glad they kept me around. Even when I was in hospital, I didn't tell them. Like I didn't tell them about any of this story, and like most of my family didn't know any of this. The people in my platoon, they didn't know about any of this. So like no one knew any of this until like I actually sat down and wrote it like in 2025. And so that was kind of like the first, let's see, 2016 to 2019. That was like the first 3 years of my military career. And then I went to the hospital, ended up learning two important things that helped me turn my life around at that point. The first being was that not all suicidal people want to end their life. Really, it's a call for help, and they're trying to figure out their situation. And when they can't figure out their situation, that's typically when I feel like someone ends their life. So that one helped me out a lot. And then the second one I really ran with, which was it was like a little pamphlet inside the hospital, and it said you can have a perfectly healthy mind, but if you believe you're depressed, then your brain will make you depressed.
True.
And I was like, okay, I know I had a messed up mind at this point. I was very self-aware. I had a lot of self-hatred for people, the army, myself, and everything like that. And so I took that thought. I'm like, okay, well, if I hate myself, what if I could convince my mind that I could be happy again? And so I really got into that, and I kind of pursued that for about 2 to 3 years before I turned my life around. I still didn't really tell anyone what was going on. I still kind of tried to figure everything out on my own. And that's where we get to the title of the book, Answering the Hard Questions, is before I went to the hospital, I kind of had to make my mind up. I'm like, all right, do you want to live or die? And that's like the very first question I asked myself. It's like, do you want to die? And it was no, which is why I like that suicidal fact. It's like I already admitted that I didn't want to die. And then I kind of had to find a reason that I wanted to live. And so I was like, look back at my life,
You're
I'm
kind of in a
like,
no man's land at that
well,
point, yeah.
yeah. And so I looked back at my life, I'm like, can it get much worse than this? You know? And so I was like, maybe I would like to live before I die a little bit, before I end everything. And so I kind of made my mind up before I went to the hospital. I'm like, let me try this thing again called life. And yeah, that's where the book starts, and that's like pretty much chapter one.
Okay. Man, that is a to say an opening is an understatement. I hear all that, and I go back to when I was a recruiter. Back in 2008 to 2012, I was a recruiter when I was enlisted, and it's a brutal job. That and drill sergeant, the hours are brutal. You're dealing with a kind of a gray area. I mean, recruits are different because they're not soldiers yet, but I remember having people that made the decision to join, and then for whatever reason they would change, and I always wondered, I told lots of people this, that I think it made me a better leader when I crossed over to be an officer right after that. I genuinely think it made me be a better officer because I got to see a lot of what you're describing. I got to go into homes that I'm like, how do y'all live here? Like this is an 8x12 trailer, and there's five of you in here, and there's a milk carton and more cigarette butts than I think you can smoke in your entire life are all over the floor, and there's a family, and you're saying you don't want to leave, and it really kind of shook me a little bit with that. And so when you're describing all that, my brain's just going there of like, I don't think people know some of the environments people leave, and I say it made me a better leader because when I was a commander, I was adamant about leave and passes. Like I was like, I had a come to Jesus moment with my entire company. I was like, look, the only name on a leave form that says disapprove is me. I was like, so if you submit a leave form, I was like, and it's going to be disapproved, I will personally come tell you that I can't send you on leave. Because you, whatever your reason is for wanting to go, I don't care if it's your friend's funeral, your friend's wedding, your dog is sick at home, or your mom is sick. I mean, there's a billion reasons. It's not my position, to question that. But I hated when leaders were like, "Oh yeah, the commander didn't approve your leave." I'm like, "The hell I didn't! I never even saw the leave form." And it drove me mad when I was at E4, and oh yeah, the commander said no. Then I'd run to the commander at the chow hall or something stupid, and I'm like, sir, why'd you not approve my leave? He's like, I never even saw a leave form with your name on it. I'm like, I'm gonna choke somebody. I'm gonna lose my freaking mind, and I swore I'd never be that leader that not gonna speak in someone's name, but it's your stories like this. This is extreme by all means, but like you reported to your unit right after your mother's passed away. And I took that stuff to heart when I had my in briefing with new soldiers all the time. Like, look, there's stuff you got going on that I'll never understand. I may look like I have my life together, but I get it, and I was very honest with my soldiers in the same way. Like, look, I've got a severely autistic kid at home. You see me, I'm in uniform, you're in uniform, I'm in my office, whatever, I'm in command and staff meetings or whatever, right? But we don't know what's going on at home, and in someone's head. I'm trying to figure out how to get my son to not burn the school down, because that's my fear is one day. I mean, one day, true story, he like snapped at school. He was third grade, second grade, and stripped butt naked and climbed on top of a bookcase and proceeded to throw books butt naked at the teacher, and screaming like a monkey, ooh! And throw him like he's throwing bananas at him, For 3.5 hours, he did this. They couldn't get him down,
Oof.
so they had to evacuate the classroom, and put in a different room as the teacher and the principal for 3.5 hours trying to get him down because he wouldn't get down, and they can't lay hands on him and all these things. So I'm like, I'm getting that phone call as a commander, So I'm like, if I'm dealing, not that my life is better or anything superior, I'm like, I know Joe is having a hard time, and I hope, and I've had plenty of people that, I went to see the hospital at Walter Reed in the psych, section, or the was it the fifth floor, sixth floor of Belvoir's Hospital, and I hope your command team or teams over that period of time, gave you the time. There's a lot of people that maybe you said they didn't know, and that's the bigger challenge, but getting to go talk, at the you just said the name of it a while ago, my brain just turned off. The counseling, they don't take notes. It's a part of the
Military Family Life Counselor.
that's a great resource. I wish more soldiers knew, like, you don't have to actually go to mental health in the hospital. You can start at a lower threshold, I guess you can call it that, and I'm glad to hear you use those resources, and because if you don't, it all goes in your head and you start lying to yourself and then you make tragic decisions. I got so many questions. I don't know where to start. I know it's a remarkable story, and to know that you still served another from where you started with that book and where you were at and everything with that. I want to hear part two. Like, I kind of just want to give you the mic and let you just go, because I'd love to hear, where did the turn go? And because for you to go from being a cav scout to crossing over and becoming I'm sure you'll get to it, being a retention or career counselor, as they call it, and is I'm sure interesting tale. So I kind of want to do that. Just let you go if you don't mind.
Yeah, I can continue on. So essentially what happened is I got out of that hospital, and then answering the hard questions kind of spawned. It wasn't on paper yet, because this was, 6 years down the road when I actually wrote the book, but the concept started the day I got out of the hospital. I sat down, I'm like, well, what would make me happy? And so that's kind of where I had to like restart my life. And I was like, I still had like 4 years left on the contract because I signed a 6-year contract. So the Army's not going to let me go at this point. And so I was like, okay, I don't really like my job at all. So maybe I can start there. And so I looked at my initial job of 68 Charlie. It's like, okay, I wanted to help people. And the combat mindset was not for me. It takes a very specific mindset to actually like that job. And so I started investigating other jobs at the time, and I tried to find something that would make me happy, and where I could help people. So, I go to the career counselor's office. Didn't know what a career counselor was at that time. I just knew I didn't want to be in my job. Gave me like a list of places to go explore. One thing led to another. I came back, I think, the next day or so. I'm like, well, what is your job? And so
What
he's
would you
like, I'm a
do
career
here?
counselor. I talk to soldier. Yeah. So he's like, I talk to soldiers. We do their contracts, their reenlistment bonuses, PCSing, and overall we help their like career and stuff like that. And I'm like, I think I could do that. So I was at E5 at the time. You had to be E5 promotable. I just got notified I was going on a deployment to Germany. So I'm like, cool, I can get that promotable status when I'm on Germany. And then the other part was I had to go to Department of the Army retention training. And I could also do that during deployment. And so I kind of like used that as a goal to not focus on everything that was going bad in my life. And so anytime I got mad or anytime I was getting stressed out, I would focus on like, I'm no longer going to be a scout in a year or two. I'm going to be a career counselor. And so I just kind of ignored the negative stuff that was going on and focused on that. And even when I got to Germany, there was still stuff that was going on. Like I I stopped going to counseling because originally I started the counseling at Fort Hood. They cut it off when I went to Germany, and then I still had like the antidepressants. I stopped taking those once I got to Germany, so I only took like one or two of them, and because it kept making me tired, so I'm like, this ain't really doing anything for me. So I quit those cold turkey. I actually still have the bottle from 2019 off to this in my storage. Yeah, it's in the next room. So I kind of like use that as like a memory of like this is where I came from. Like when stuff gets bad, and I kind of try to force my way through it. I eventually did, but a couple things like Germany wasn't perfect either. So I ended up going to Department of the Army Retention Training Program, got my certificate in that, and then I was the training room at the time. So the first sergeant. And I could see the promotions and stuff like that. So I knew when my name was going to be on that, when not on the board, and I could see, first sergeant mark it off and stuff like that. And at this point, I was
The best
talking to
job.
them 9 months. I'm
Controller
like,
room's
hey,
great.
yeah, I
You
loved
know
it.
everything.
It got, yeah, really, really cool job, actually. I actually enjoyed it a lot. But where was I? Yeah,
Sorry.
so. 9 months went by. During this 9 months, they knew I was reclassing. They knew I was trying to become a career counselor, both the company commander and the first sergeant. And I was sitting there working with the career counselor every day, to show him that I wanted the job. And so he turned in my mentor during that time. And so gets to the month where my name's on the board. And so I go to look at my name, and there's an X by my name. And so I'm like, hey, first sergeant, you marked an X by my name. We've been talking about this for like 9 months. He's like, yeah, I meant to talk to you. We'll talk in a little bit about it. So we have a one-on-one conversation. And essentially, he's like, hey, because we took you to the training room, you don't have your scout platoon time as a E5. Even though, I had two supply soldiers under me the entire deployment, but he wouldn't count my time because I wasn't a scout. And he's like, but I was like, I'm trying to reclass. And I'm trying to get out of this MOS. The scout platoon time doesn't matter to me. And went back and forth with him 5 times, and eventually came back to it's like he wouldn't sign it. And so then at that point, I had to go after Germany. I had to go back to the scout platoon, which I'm like wasn't already liking because I'm like I don't like this job at all. And at that time, I during deployment for people who've never been on one. People get very close to each other. It's like the people you work with become like your family and stuff like that. The problem was that I'm still single at this point. And so in the back of my mind, I'm like, I'm about to come back from this deployment. Everyone's going to go off, do their own thing. 'Cause this was my second deployment. I know how it goes at this point. And I'm like, I'm going to go home alone again. And I'm just going to, go back to the same place. So I start reinstalling dating apps and stuff like that again. And so during that deployment, I kind of did like a full 360 to where I was like back in the same situation. I'm going back to the scout
Oh,
platoon. I'm
man.
back on dating apps and all the stuff like that. And so that was the real turning point of the book. And both of these situations. So I ended up getting back my mentor for the career counselor. He was getting ready to leave. And I'm like, what do I have to do to get out of here? He's like, well, there's a retention NCO of the year competition. He's like, if you go to that, you pass it, that'll get you your spot right away. So I'm like, cool. Studied, went to the board. I was the only one in our division to show up to that board for the retention NCOs. So right off the bat, they're like, hey, we love this because, out of thousands of people, you're the only one to show up and show initiation. So I just had to go in there and pass and, not make a fool of myself. Ended up doing really well. They're like, hey, you got some of the questions right that the career counselors missed. So I was like, all right. So that pretty much secured my slot right there. And then while my mentor was leaving, I found my next mentor who eventually she's like, hey, while the career counselor's gone and there's a vacant spot, I want you to do full-time retention. So that got me out of the scout platoon again. So, we just killed two birds with one stone.
Nailed it.
And then there was, the dating website aspect. So a couple of things happened to get me off the dating website. The first was that when I came back from deployment in Germany, I had to get a vehicle and I had to move out because they needed space in the barracks at this point. So I was a E5. I got my first vehicle, which was like a Jeep Wrangler, expensive vehicle. And then I also had to pay rent. Now, Army finances, not always the best.
Slow, slow.
They ended up messing up my pay, so they didn't pay me like I was in the barracks until like 2 or 3 months down the road. So eventually I had like $5 left in my bank account because I couldn't keep up with all the bills, the driving, and everything else going on. So that helped me get off, the premium dating websites and the predatory stuff like that. And then I ended up getting a match. And this really helped me move on with my life. They tried to do the age scam on me again, and it was almost identical to the first one. But this time I played it out because I could notice the patterns by this time because, after a year of going through like several occasions of getting blackmailed, I could identify like all the signs and the repetitions. So I kind of used that experience. I'm like, continued on with the conversation. Now, luckily, I wasn't dumb enough to send them anything back this time, but I'm like, I blocked them and stuff like that. And then they tried to do the same story as last time. This time they posed as an investigator and they're like, hey, this person's in the hospital. I'm like, that sounds familiar. And
Same
the first
script,
thing
different
the
day.
officer, yep. And so they started questioning me. My heart's racing at this point. I'm like, is this really happening to me again? And I'm like, this time law enforcement's calling me. So I'm like, they wanted my address. So I'm like, hold up. If you're a law enforcement investigator, you probably already have my information. And so I start listening to their conversation. I let them go on for about 10 minutes. I'm like, hey, I've been through this before. I know you're scamming me. I'm like, if you call me again, I'm going to start a real investigation and we're going to see who's real this time. Because they didn't have it on me, anything on me at this time. They're just trying to, get me to fold my hand at this point. And they never called me back. And I'm like, then I looked at the first situation. I'm like, well, maybe that first one wasn't real as well. And I talk about it in the book a lot because that's why I wrote the book, because I was like, so one of the things I did towards the end of the book, I put my story in there with the chapter one, and I threw it in the chat GPT just to get some feedback. I'm like, what were the odds of me surviving all these situations? And they're like 10 to 20%. And so I really looked at those odds and I'm like, okay. And then I eventually went to the career counselor course, passed in 2022. And when I passed, I'm like, okay, maybe I have a story to tell. Now that I finally turned my life around and, everything started going pretty well for me, and I had a very good reputation as a career counselor. And so in 2025, no, it was 2024, late 2024, I eventually worked up the courage. I started putting it in a PowerPoint to present to my peers. So one of my bosses looked at it. He's like, hey, this is cool. And then he recommended MRT, Master Resilience
Let's
Trainer.
try. Right, yeah. The glass
Now they
ball,
changed the
the tennis
name to
ball.
something. But yeah, I ended up really liking the course. And
Did
then our
you
division
go to the
training for the
Army?
career counselor.
Sorry, did you go to the Army course in, is it Jackson, or did you go to the University of Pennsylvania version?
So we had a MRT course in Campbell. So we
Okay,
were, so I was
gotcha.
able to just go down the road.
Yeah,
Yeah. So we
well, because
went there.
the
I ended up
original
passing
court
it.
the original course was in was from people that devised that were from University of Pennsylvania, like neurology department, I think. And it's pretty remarkable course. Sorry.
Yeah, it's actually a really good course. If it was still around, I'd recommend it. It's Ready and Resilient now. They changed the name. I think they've changed some stuff in it as well. But yeah, really good class. Ended up, some of the ideas helped me write the book and stuff like that. And then our division career counselor, our command career counselor, wanted to do training. No one had any ideas, so I'm like, okay, let me put together an MRT class. I ended up doing that, but I ended up swapping it. I ended up going back to my original PowerPoint that wasn't really involved around MRT, but instead it was called like changing your mind and stuff like that. And it was really the story I gave you. It was a really rough draft, wasn't that great. Ended up getting rejected. And then I also got notified that I was going to Kuwait. So now we're in early 2025. And at this point, I'm like, I really want to tell this story. And so I got to Kuwait about 10 pages into the book. I'm like, I'm going to write this book. I'm going to go tell my story. And then I made my mind up. I'm like, I'm going to leave the army to go write this book. So that's the real reason I made the decision to actually get out. Not anything like against the army, because I'm still a career counselor. I'm still an advocate for the army, and I still encourage people to do it. But it was really to actually sit down and write the story and, force myself to tell everyone what was going on in my life and stuff like that. So fast forward, I'm about to lock in my manuscripts and get the book published. We're towards the end of the deployment. And they asked me if I wanted to do any training for like an NCR bowl and stuff like that. So I'm like, I rewrote that original PowerPoint. I looked at it and then I looked at my book and I pretty much took the opening chapter of my book, put it inside a PowerPoint to present to people for leadership. And my sergeant major at the time, he's like, yeah, I would love for you to do this. And so I was originally going to do it for leadership. And then he's like, I'm going to have you do this for a suicide awareness class for redeployment training instead. So instead of just, 10, 20 people, this ended up being like 200, 300 people. Went very well. Did it in a theater. Did it once or twice. I think I've done that opening chapter with the concepts of the book. I think I did that about 5 times now. And so it's great, had great review and stuff like that. And that really ended up being a chapter in the book itself to where I'm like, okay, this shows me that I'm not the only one alone. So in that PowerPoint, I always ask people a question. I would always ask them 7 questions, and they were all 2 questions didn't apply to me, but and then 5 would apply to me. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to make this fair. I'm going to raise my hand for these vulnerable questions as well so that they can kind of get my story. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to actually tell you about these vulnerable moments like I just told you. And the one I always thought I was going to be alone on was I'm like, hey, has anyone ever been blackmailed? And every time I present the
Oh yeah.
PowerPoint or the presentation,
Ten
there's
hands.
like 5 to 20 people who raise their
Yeah.
hand. I'm like, okay, so I'm not alone. I was never alone. And I kind of realized at that moment, I'm like, okay, maybe this is a story everyone wants to hear, but no one wants to be the one to write it and be vulnerable with people.
Right.
And so, that's really when I knew that my book, I was like, okay, I need to continue writing this book. And that became a pretty good chapter in the book as well. And then
Well, I think
I ended up
not,
coming
not to
back from
cut you.
Kuwait.
Sorry, not to cut you off, but I think you hit a really good point there. We have to talk about that. Is that lie, the lie of thinking you're alone, I think is the biggest poison that gets in people's heads for anything, and it can be just I'm alone, my spouse doesn't care about me, and then there's that lie, and then you can go into great the other side of it where no one's ever dealt with anything that like I'm dealing with. I'm alone in being blackmailed. I'm alone in a online scam or anything like that, and I think that is not reassurance, it's the wrong word, but like that realization of that you're not alone, is the first step to overcoming, any of that. So I don't know your thoughts on that,
Yeah.
but
Yeah, that's one of the core concepts of the book. And that's what the second title is about, passing on hope to others. So one of the things I tend to say, is by telling our stories, not just mine, but yours as well. We take the impossible out of someone else's situation, and if it's no longer impossible, then that might get someone not to end their life.
Right.
So that's one of the concepts of the book. And then telling people that you're not alone. It's really silence is like the number one killer because we think we're alone, and it's like the lies we tell ourselves in silence. That's what ends up killing us all.
Yeah. And then you take that same
So
silence,
that
though, and
message.
you're with your family or friends or your coworkers or whatever it is, and you maintain silence, thinking like one is I'm alone in this. And two, if I speak about this, the embarrassment side of being alone publicly is like, it's too much to bear. Like, I can't tell anybody I've been blackmailed online. Like they'll mock, the platoon will mock me for the rest of my life, which is in the infantry and cavalry and tank world is we're not very polite in some ways, but it's the realization is like, if you told your platoon that or your squad or whatever they call it in the cav world, it's you're not you're it, you probably would have had one or two guys been like, hey, that was me too. I just don't want to raise my hand because it's I'm embarrassed. So
Yeah, so I'll actually circle back on that because it's another thing I think I skipped over a little bit. But when I originally went to a hospital, like no one knew any of these things I was actually going through. I was in a platoon of about 30 people. Only one of them knew that I was going through like some stressful situations, and it was able to kind of see it coming. And that's what's really dangerous because it's like the problem wasn't them necessarily, but it was me and the lies I was telling myself. By doing the PowerPoint and that presentation, that's kind of that was really when it clicked that it was on me, not my platoon. And because even when I went to the hospital, I told him, like, hey, I've been considering ending my life. My NCO had to come pick me up and take me to the hospital to escort me. He's like, hey, man, I've been through the same situation before. And, even people who I didn't get along with at the time, they met me at the hospital and, like, I had no idea, you were feeling this way. And, like, I had that combat mindset of like, okay, I'm going to be made fun of, I'm going to be made weak, but no, it was reinsurance when I went to the hospital. And I think that me going to the hospital, I think that changed a couple lives in itself, but based on, how we treat each other. So I think that was a turning point for some people. But yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. I think that's a I've been that person to pick somebody up as an NCO, and I've been that person as a commander having to go visit after, the word gets to me, and you're sitting there and you're like, what the heck, dude? Like, you think you're alone in this? Like, and I remember very well sitting at Walter Reed, gosh, on a Saturday morning from like 9 to 11, just hanging out with me and the soldier of mine and his S6 NCO. And we were just laughing, having a great time. And I kind of shifted it and was like, dude, it ain't it's, this job is not that serious. If you're throwing all this hate to the army, all this hate towards the job or the schedule or the op tempo, whatever it was, and if this has been around for hundreds of years, and so what you're trying to blame on us isn't fair. It's something else. And if you can't be honest with yourself, then we can't be honest and try to help you, and he had a pretty interesting breakdown in that moment of just time of like any not to rank people's problems or struggles or lives and stuff, but it was rather, if yours is a 10, his was an 8. Of just like, okay, so all that has nothing to do with the army. All that happened long before, you ever raised your hand, and we can work through those things. We can talk about those things. We can get you help for those things. And his he had a found out he had a family member that had gone to prison, for some pretty heinous acts, and so it was. And it was just getting to him, and he wanted to take it out on the army. I'm like, that's not our fault, man. Like, we have nothing to do with, your cousin going bonkers, And so it's, I think all of those things in everyone's lives and the day-to-day stuff, you just don't, people don't know how to share those things, And I respect you and that you wrote a book about it, which is phenomenal in of itself, and I. Because to sit down and be that open and vulnerable, I mean, you have pages and you literally can be as descriptive as you want to be, or you can be as passive as you want to be. So having to put it all in a book is like a huge leap of healing, I would argue, and I'm sure that that process has probably been some tear shed when you're typing, I would assume.
There was definitely some chapters where I'm like, all right, I need to take a break before I start breaking down. Even I think there's only one time where I allowed like one tear to come out. I was like, all right, we'll allow this one. But there was definitely some moments, and like even when I was writing the book itself, there was times I'm like, am I actually going to sit down and put this publicly? Because there's a chapter in there that gets very explicit. It's in chapter 4. It's called A Glimpse into Hell. And, I breezed over, getting blackmailed like 7 times. But in that section of the book, I'm like, I went into very graphic detail and very explicit detail because I'm like, I want you to know that this is real and I'm not making this up. So I actually go in depth on every situation of when I was blackmailed and what they did. and what were the consequences of it. And so I was like, I have to make this vulnerable to where no one's going to be ashamed of telling their story.
Yeah.
And like the most vulnerable point and most explicit point of the book, I end up, t it was, I was like 21, 22 at the time. I found not a scammer, and I got a match, but ended up being like a pretty much an online prostitute. And I go into that, I tell that story. I'm like, you know, I went there, and I sold like my virginity for money at that point. And then on top of that, I ended up getting chlamydia, and I go into graphic details in the book about that.
Yeah.
I'm like, if you've ever seen like The Green Mile or something like that, to where like he's on his knees crying, I'm like, that's accurate. That's
Yeah.
how it feels.
Yeah.
Because like at that point, like the pain is so real that you go to the bathroom within that hour. I probably went like 15 times going to the bathroom. And it's like the worst burning sensation you'll ever feel, to where it's like after like the 10th time, I started peeing out blood and mucus. And that's, you know, how I knew I had some issues
Something's
that
not right.
were developing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, something, maybe someone else was right. Now, luckily, that was curable, but that's like, that took me, even when I was writing the book, I almost didn't put it in there, but I'm like, nope, I'm going to do this because someone out there is probably going through it right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let it be the end of the chapter, not the end of the book. So that's the subtitle of the book. And really, it's like, the other title of it was a little more grim, so I came up with this one, was like The Untold Consequences of Suicide. So I'm
Yeah.
like, what if someone's going through the exact same situation I'm in, but I decide to end my life? Well, then I take away hope for whoever has to read my story now. Like, and that's what let it be the end of the chapter means, and not the end of the
Yeah.
book.
Yeah, it continues. Right. I told you when we first got on, that's a great, I'm kind of jealous actually. It's a great, as a person who's writing a book right now as well, and it's that's a daunting step to what letters go on the front, because we judge books by the cover. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
everyone says, "Oh, we don't know." I'm like, but we do. It's like dating sites. You judge people by their profile picture. I mean, it's no different and all that. But, well, where are you at today then? Let's writing and taking a year plus to write a book. People don't realize it takes a while, and getting it published and everything. That's all good and great. But where are you at? And you're about to get out of the army, and what are you planning on doing?
Yeah, so for me to actually sit down and write the book, most of it took about 6 months. And so I had most of it done on July of 2025. When it comes to that, I actually almost ended the book a little too soon, which was the irony of the actual title of the book, because I almost ended my own book too soon. So I was about to lock the manuscript in, and the editor, chief editor, he was like, "Hey, you know, it's a good book, but he's like, you lean in too much of the self-help and not your story. He's like, people don't know you yet, so it's like you need to tell your story before you tell them why they should listen to you." And so within a week, I added another 100 pages of the book, and that's where all the memoir of the book comes in, and
Yeah.
the vulnerable moments and the actual story, and it really pieced the book together.
Yeah.
And then the publication process, that was like an additional 6 months, and
Yeah.
so that takes forever. And then so it just released on March 31st. So a couple things have been happening with it so far. So within the first week, it went number one on Amazon in a couple different categories for Kindle. So that was a really
Great.
cool experience. What happened last week, it actually received a Firebird Award, which is like an international award, so that was pretty cool. And then it just got professionally reviewed yesterday by Indie Reader, and it got like a 4.5 rating, so I just answered some questions
Awesome.
for them.
Congratulations.
So it's off to a really good start. You know, I just got to figure out finances and how much money I can make. But really, I didn't, so I pretty much saved up money on the deployment, and I kind of made up my mind. I'm like, I'm going to see where the book takes me rather than have like a hard plan. I'm like, okay, I can talk about the book, I can make this speaking, I can talk to people about what they're going through and how they're reading it. And so I didn't make like a typical career counselor plan. I actually went against a lot of the career
I did
counselor
everything
ways.
I'm not supposed to
Yeah, except for saving up money. But what I'm doing right now is that I've, as you can see by this episode, I've got with a PR team and we're doing like a almost like a podcasting tour.
Yeah.
So this is like my sixth or seventh one in like a
Great.
couple weeks. And then I have like another six after this. So right now it's really just spreading the word and seeing where the book actually takes me.
That's awesome, man. Glad to hear it. It's a daunting task, and it's scary, and because it's so such an unknown world to people to write, and I encourage people all the time, like if it's anything, if it's in your phone or your notes section, just put stuff down, because one, we get older, we forget, and when you're in the moment though, like I've got a on my phone in the notes section, I've got, gosh, I think like 80 different little tabs going, but one of them I have is called, it says book ideas. And I'll literally be driving with my wife or walking through Kroger getting groceries or something. Something will ping, 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 ping in my head, and I'll like outline an entire book, of an idea of something. And maybe it's just an idea of a concept, or it's a full thing. So I commend you for going through with it, 'cause it is a lot. And then you give it to an editor and they criticize it, and they're like, "Oh no, you suck with commas." like, "I don't know commas." So it's the
Yeah.
good.
Oh, I was gonna say, so what people notice that it's an easy read because this is coming from someone who's just been in the army for like 10 years,
Yeah.
been out of school for 10 years, so I don't write.
Yeah.
And so the editors definitely had their work cut out for them
Yeah.
because I'm good at I guess storytelling and stuff like that, but like grammar is like my worst subject. It still
Yeah.
is. Like I just don't
Yeah.
understand it. So I'm like, I'm just gonna write. I have my Grammarly that'll help me edit my commas
Yeah.
a little bit for me.
Grammarly's great.
But the concept you're the concept of writing it down was exactly how I wrote this book.
Yeah.
I still have the tabs today to where I'm like, I don't know if you've seen the preview of it, but what did I end up doing is the 80 concepts you have. I took that and I kind of made each one their own little segment, and that's how the book was actually made.
Absolutely.
So I still have all that stuff. I still have the entire draft. So I have like 50 documents in my folder when creating the book. And
Yeah.
I'm still doing that to this day. So like even though I'm like waiting on figuring this book out, I'm already like 50 pages like into the next one with whole new concepts and
Yeah.
like a whole new direction.
Part two. Yeah.
But I would strongly encourage, what you said as well, because there's times at night where I had like an idea in my head. I didn't write it down. I'm like, it was gone forever. I'm like, well, that
Yeah.
sucks.
Well, if you listen to any interviews, and it's so great now because there's so many podcasts out there. But you get musicians, particularly, are notorious for having that notepad and pen on their nightstand on the table. Like it's there. If they wake up and like had a dream, like, and I get down that lyric, or whatever that chord sequence, or the whatever it is that comes to their Charlie Puth has been on a lot of shows lately about that, and
Oh,
talks
I've
about
seen
how,
that.
how he just will get the craziest idea. I mean, it's the song Light Switch. He talks about how he just, like, he literally recorded himself on YouTube, like raw ideas as he goes through. So there's a lot to it, and a lot of healing in that too. So where are you at with, not the book, but your own? If you had to rank 10 being I'm the healthiest person in the world, and one is I'm going to end it all tomorrow, where would you put your mental health at today? And you don't, no pressure to say 10 by any means.
Yeah. So like I think it's like the very first paragraph I talk to people about in the book, and I'm like, all these things I talk about, like they don't just go away. They're always there,
No.
and you just have the adaptability to be like, okay, no, this is a lie. I've already overcome this. And you kind of have to like silence those voices and put them in their place, and that's kind of, what resilience is to me overall. So it's
Yeah.
like I still think about this stuff that happens in my book. All the time. I just look at it from a different lens instead of like, oh man, this is all suffering and bad stuff. I'm like, well, this was another chapter in the book that can help someone else.
Yeah.
So I really try to look at everything from a positive aspect. I would say a month or two ago, I was doing pretty bad. I was probably like at a 4 or 5. I've recovered since then, so I'm probably like at an 8 or 9 again.
Good.
But that's just because I'm going through some other journeys right now, and I had a lot of old memories coming back, and it was almost for like about a month or two. It's almost like I forgot my book for a second.
Yeah.
And then I had to come up with like almost like new systems and new ideas. And so that was a struggle for a couple
Yeah.
months. But yeah.
Okay. So you're in Campbell now. Are you getting out here in a few weeks and stuff? Where are you headed to? Are you staying in that area or?
So I'm staying in the area. So I'm still like right outside Campbell. I'm like 5 minutes like off base, stuff like that. I don't have any plans for moving yet. If I wanted to move, I could go back to Illinois. Probably not going to go back there, based off, what we said earlier.
Hasn't been, it
Still
wasn't a good start.
still
Yeah.
not a great city.
Yeah.
So
Where's your dad at?
I'm still staying in the
Sorry.
local area. He's
You.
in Illinois. So he's still in Rockford. So
Okay.
I go see them about like, once a year, but I try to stay away from the city in general. And
Yeah.
even he knows that he wants to eventually get out of that state.
Was it, we never
Because
closed the
he's
loop
been trying to move on with his life for about 3 or 4 years.
we never closed the loop on what happened, if he got to jail or if he's deceased or something. I was making sure what was going on with that.
So after his hospital trip, he had kind of like one more freak out before I took off for basic training. And then by the time I got back, he was doing pretty good. So for the last 3 or 4 years, he has been sober. So he's
Good.
got his life back on
That's
track.
great.
I don't think he did any jail time. He got his license suspended for like a couple years, but he's got that back now as well. So he's pretty much
That's great
off all
news.
of his stuff, and he's been doing great. He's really changed his entire life around as well.
That's fantastic.
And then I think part of it was me leaving. Maybe he just kind of like needed that reset
The
to be able to
pressure.
focus like on his own life. And then I think me leaving and turning my life around kind of also helped him, because he's like, hey, I'm really glad that you turned out better than me, because he never wanted me to be like him,
Yeah.
even from like a very young age. So he's kind of very self-aware. He's like, I don't want you being like me.
Yeah.
We have things in common, but he knew all the stuff he was doing. And
Yeah.
so that was one good aspect to like really him getting me off to the army was probably the best thing he could have done.
Yeah.
Because even though it started off like bad for like the first 3 years, it ended up helping me turn my life around, and
Yeah.
everyone's been able to kind of like recognize that.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. Well, not to cut this short or wrap it up, but where aside from Amazon, I have it right here on my screen. You can go to Amazon and type in Devin Fish, and it's the first book that pops up. Answering the Hard Questions is the title, and Let It Be the End of the Chapter, not the End of the Book, which is. Still so jealous of that. It's so great. I really am. That's a good one. Where else can they, is it available in any bookstores or is there a website for it or anything
So I don't have like an official like author website.
or?
It could pretty much be found, and it's an ebook, it's in paperback, it's in hardcover.
Okay.
So pretty much anywhere you can find those, you can find them. Like,
Okay.
it's on Kodobo, it's on iBook, it's on Kindle, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. I don't know if it's gotten into the stores yet. But every website I've been able to visit, they've had it online at least,
Great.
or orderable.
Great. Well, I'll definitely put the link here to the Amazon will be in the description of the episode. So if you're listening, quick link to it and get it. It's a it sounds like a pretty remarkable story just from the few minutes we've had here this past hour. And I'm very intrigued of the more detail of your life and Devin. And man, I'm glad you didn't make a horrible decision. That's the only way I can put that. It's a everyone wants to say selfish. Yeah, I think it's. I don't ever view suicidal ideations as selfish. It's just perspective, and when your perspective is your world's falling apart, you're not being selfish. Your world's falling apart. So I'm glad you're still here, man. And thank you for being very, very vulnerable and telling your story because it needs to be heard. And I don't. The biggest thing again, I go back to is people the lie that you're alone. because you're not. And I think that's there's more than that in big bold text in your book, I'm sure, but it's a powerful message to hear, and you're still going through it, and that says a lot. It's a lot to be in the middle of a fight and then write a book about the fight that you're currently in, and it continues on. So I look forward to actually part two. I think that'll be the even more powerful of how your life continues and how this book does, and all these things is great, but as life goes on, and if there's a spouse or kids and everything, because it'll that perspective shifts significantly,
Oh, yeah.
and whatnot. So, but thanks for being on the show, and do you have any closing comments?
No, thanks for having me. And again, let it be the end of the chapter, not the end of the book.
I love it. So, all right. Well, if you haven't subscribed to the show, by all means, please do. And otherwise, we'll see you on the next episode.